He's the expert, so.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Joint Interim Task Force on Oregon Retirement Savings. It was established by House Bill 3436. We have one member who's on the way, but out of deference to everybody's busy schedules, I think we'll go ahead and start, and I'll catch her up if necessary. Today, we're going to talk about the research in best practices to increase participation in savings plans. We have three presentations today. And we have three what I think are going to be outstanding sets of presenters. And then we're going to spend about the last 45 minutes of our meeting discussing some proposed recommendations. I asked Dick to take a first draft based on all the testimony that we've received so far, just as truly a trial pony, just to give us a framework for conversation. We're not voting on anything today. We're just having a conversation. And we'll start taking... we'll have more deliberation and votes following in our August meeting. So I think we'll start with Bert. You're up first. Bert is, of course, a member of our task force, and we've asked him to do some research on the subject of education, financial information. I hope that's right. And if it's not, he's giving his presentation on something else.
And his printed materials are in your packet, by the way.
Yeah, quote. My three pages are about seven pages down, and they're not. First of all, thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Mr. Wheeler, for hearing me. And
my pleasure.
If you can't hear me, speak up. I appreciate being on this panel, task force. I was kind of a late appointee, so I've been playing catch up, and this may be my 10, 15 minutes of glory. I noticed on the materials that were here in front of me. Open up the first one from Ng. Retirement investing is a real activity, not an isolated discipline. In Mr. Shlomo's book, providentially, I opened it up. Tangible account statement. That means a lot, what I'm going to be talking about. Tangible as opposed to intangibles. Something that makes you feel and understand. My background before I came to sunny Oregon 36 years ago, I was actually a school teacher, an educator, and I had the great privilege of studying under Sidney B. Simon, who's noted as the father of values clarification out of the University of Massachusetts. One of his disciples and devotee of Mr. Simon is a certain William H. Cosby. Bill Cosby went to school. I didn't have same classes with him, but a lot of Mr. Cosby's work and everything shows the need for values and education and feelings. Wow, I've covered the first paragraph and a half already. As an insurance and financial advisor, I found the training that I had in values clarification to be wonderful because I've been selling primarily intangibles for 36 years to a predominantly mom-and-pop marketplace or small business. I'm not a rich financial advisor like some. I've spent my life working with everyday people. And so much of what I've seen is over the head of everyday people. And one of my goals is to make people feel and bring it down to earth. Intangible, from the dictionary. Something that cannot be touched. Incorporeal. Incorporeal. Boy, figure a dictionary is going to put something in. You have to go to another dictionary to figure it out. Something that cannot easily be defined, vague. Sale of intangibles is probably the hardest form of selling. The ministry, and I testified on life insurance to save the tax advantages, life insurance, the ministry is probably the highest form of selling intangibles. I sell life insurance. It's another intangible. You can't feel it or taste it. I've often thought that it was mixed up. I was selling death insurance. That doesn't sell well, a sound of death. But the minister is selling life insurance. Another intangible, somebody smiled out there. Another intangible is savings. You don't feel it, you don't taste it. On the Ng documents here, which I saw, talk about an account statement, a tangible account statement, so somebody can see what's going on as they progress. Somebody can see how they're progressing, and maybe even a calculation of what this will give you in an income later on. Just what's needed to encourage people to keep savings. But how do you get them to stock? values clarification is really feelings clarification. The task force were mandated to find new or improved methods to encourage people to believe in the benefits of deferred gratification through saving for retirement, which, as I said, is another intangible for the most part. State-mandated classroom activities have fallen short. There hasn't been emphasis on them, and I think there's been a failure to implement some of the projects that were recommended in the 1997 study. This draft is a work in progress. Simply put yourself back in the fourth grade. Think of yourself as fourth graders today. And you have and knowing that teachers and educators have so many mandates that, for the most part, they don't want to take on something new unless it's shoved down their throats. A great number of their students don't know what work is. And I say that they come from an impoverished background where earning money, working, and getting compensation is really a new concept. My wife is a retired minister, over 30 years of experience, and 20% approximately of the parents she deals with are not working. So the sidelight of this earn and save program is a work ethic, too, that might come from it. Simply put, the financial cost of earn and save would be covered by the private industry. We're looking at a class of 30, maybe being around $400 expenditure, and only 10 hours of teacher time, and only 3 hours of classroom time, something that would be easy to go down, something that would be easy to be practiced, and what can be learned. The ad, I guess. Class of fourth grade students for 10-week project. No experience necessary. Elementary entry-level positions, 15 minutes a week assembling widgets. When I say widgets, we're trying to find what would be a work project. It's not charity, because we don't want to have the young people think that they should get paid for doing a charity. Something for 15 minutes a week, and they get paid for it. And the pay compensation will be $1 per week for 10 weeks. Deferred savings plan optional. Take 50 cents a week, young person, now, and at the end of 10 weeks, you'll get the 50 cents plus another 50 cents. Your choice. Special provisions. Once you've signed up for the matching funds, employers cannot opt out. Employees cannot opt out. They can, however, sign up for matching funds anytime down the line. Weekly savings records will be posted so everybody in the class sees who's saved and how much. And in the end, there'll be a final posting of who gets what money from the savings plan after 10 weeks. Short, sweet, simple. Some parents will say it's wrong, probably a permission slip, but what we don't want is parents having input necessarily. We don't want the teacher saying, Johnny, you ought to do that. We want the kids to learn and feel on their own. Some will feel badly if they didn't save the extra. Wonderful, because that's what values clarification is feeling, getting to feel it and understand it by doing a short 10-week program. Not that there aren't others, not that there isn't a vast amount of other mandated programs, but something just this simple can make all the difference in a young person's life, and a dollar still means something to a fourth grader, and it's a dollar, not script to be spent at the school store and not to be based on charity. So if anybody has any ideas on what would be a 15-minute project per week, 4 hours of work for a student, to give them $10 or maybe $15 all totaled. But that's what values clarification is about in the simplest form. Goals accomplished. Feel the benefits of gratification deferred through saving. Understand, for some, money can be earned. I'm dealing with one of these paper clips here. I've got 4 copies of this. I don't know which one to use. They all read the same, except the yellow marked up in different places. Earn and Save could be the first step in a comprehensive, legislatively mandated, hands-on series of educational units to have young people feel the values of saving through deferred gratification. Should be programs, and there are already programs out there. There are volunteers going into the school, but there's got to be a unified, consistent approach, and it's got to be mandated by the legislature and the Department of Education to get it done. Anything less is going to be a travesty. In reality, when it comes to savings, 20% of the people that I work with who sign up or can sign up for Simple Plan, where an employer puts in $10 and the employee has to put in 10 and they get $10 for free, 20% won't do it because they have to give up $10 today. Other plans are similar throughout the country. What is missing? We've got to work on the psyche of the individuals. In reality, when it comes to savings, if people want to save and they've come to that conclusion, they can walk to the street corner, walk into the bank, walk into the credit union, walk into their insurance agent who also does financial advising, get some counseling, which is sometimes unavailable in the larger plans, and start up a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. And payroll deduction is wonderful. Have it taken out before somebody gets a hold of it. But I've never found that a problem for somebody who is motivated and understood savings. If they pay a mortgage, if they pay a rent check, they take out $1,000 a month, write out a check $1,000 on the fifth of the month perhaps, just subtract $1,100.
Bert, two more minutes if you can start thinking about wrapping it up.
Thank you. My concern is here is that many plans have been built, like the Field of Dreams, if you remember, build it and they will come. That's tangibles that you can smell, taste, feel. This is an intangible. And I'm afraid that I don't want to support personally something that won't work because the feelings went out of it. I want it to be a field of broken dreams. So whatever we do, whatever plan comes through, whatever plan, I think we've got to look at the values and the tangibility, and we owe it no less to the people who truly need our services. My final statement. It's a three-footed, three-legged stool that we're working with. Values education for generations, so it goes on. Generational poverty won't ensue. It's got to go on. An ongoing program, aggressive media coverage, similar to the college savings plan, which I think it makes a big difference. The commercial world today can do so much into motivating people. And lastly, I think for the small business sector in particular, which is the backbone of our economy, incentives right from the get-go when a new business starts up, to get tax breaks, to get incentives to start out with a retirement plan right from the very beginning. That may be all it needs to be done without some fancy plan or some other major thing that will be time-consuming and possibly be built on a field of broken dreams unless we can establish the need. That's it. Questions, anybody? Thank you.
Bert, thank you. We appreciate it. Next up, we have Glenn Dial, who's the Managing Director, the head of the U.S. Retirement Security Alliance Global Investors. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We appreciate it very much.
Good to be here. And as I was telling Jan, I think it's such of a worthy cause, the endeavor that you're taking on, trying to increase coverage for a lot of your residents that probably would not normally be covered by a retirement plan. And I think that's obviously worthy, and it's what a lot of other states are trying to tackle. It's what the UK has been tackling too, and we're an advisor to them. But by way of background, so I'm with Allianz Global Investors, and I've spent over 20 years of my career in the retirement industry. So I look at the world very much from a practitioner standpoint. At Allianz, we also started the Center for Behavioral Finance a little over four years ago. And this is really a partnership between the academic world and the business world, if you will, to try and bridge the two to give back to the industry. So what I plan on doing is taking the next 30 minutes or so and talking about the research we've done at the center. And I think everybody should have a book, Say More Tomorrow. This is something we published a little over 2 years ago based on Professor Shlomo Bernardsi's work. And I was I was able to be a contributor to this book, so that was it was nice to be involved in that process. So let's jump into it. And feel free to stop me along the way, by the way, if you have questions. So the book, Say More Tomorrow, is built around the principles of 90-10-90. And you might think, well, what's 90-10-90? Well, from a behavioral standpoint, you want to come up with numbers that are easy to remember. So 90-10-90 is fairly easy to remember. And what do the numbers mean? Well, it means that at least 90% of all employees should be covered in a retirement plan. Now, I think we'd all probably say it should be more like 100%, but the premise of the book was at minimum 90, not the goal, the minimum is 90% of all employees should be in a retirement plan. Again, the members of the board here would probably say it's 100%. In terms of how much should employees, should a resident be saving, minimum is 10% per year. Minimum. Now, 10%, so you know, 10% will not get them where they need to be. It's not enough. But 10% is a minimum that we need to get folks to. And then the last 90% is, well, how should they be invested? And, you know, our research shows that about 90% of all participants in a retirement plan should be in some kind of professionally managed asset allocation fund, like a target date fund. So kind of easy to remember, 90-10-90, and then I'm going to talk about some of the research that goes behind this and some of the outcomes. So when we talk about behavioral finance, just so we're on the same page, so we're combining psychology and finance, so combine the two. That little overlap area that you see in the purple is what we're talking about today. So let's talk about the 90% participation and some of the research. The biggest, you know, when you look at, and I'm going to refer to the defined contribution industry a little bit and how some 401k plans are set up. I know that's not the direction this is going, but what we'd see in that part of the industry is a lot of plans would benchmark themselves on existing participation rates. And in, let's say in their industry, they had 72% participation rate, and they were good enough to get up to a 75% participation rate. They thought that was good. What we're saying, again, is going back to the 90%, how do you get folks there? Well, let's look at Germany and Austria. So they both have organ donation programs. One is an opt-in program, one's an opt-out. Now this slide looks a lot better when it's automated, but I didn't bring the automated slides because we could guess, but the answers are already here. So in Germany, where you have to opt out of the organ donation program, you only have about 12% of the population that actually says, okay, organ donation is a good
thing. Opt-out or opt-in?
Opt-in. I'm sorry, you have to opt-in. Did I say it the wrong way? So you have to opt in Germany. So if you have to actually make that affirmative action and opt in, only about 12% of the population actually does something and will check the box, if you will. And that's all it is checking the box, just like we do. I don't know how you do it here, but in Florida, you check a box on your driver's license to opt in. Austria does it the other way. Unless you check the box, you're already in. So you see dramatically difference where if they don't have to do anything, you have a 99% participation rate in the organ donation program. So this is just a great example of how inertia affects a plan. And when we talk to plan sponsors about this, especially before we did this research, we'd get pushback saying, well, wait a minute, I don't want to be too paternalistic. I don't want to either force people in the plan or out of it. The point we're making, no matter what direction you're going, you are making a decision. So there is no neutral decision here. You either are having people opted in or they're opted out. There is no neutral site. So the other, and you'll probably see this a lot, I know some other states in terms of when they set up their their payroll deduction IRA programs have went with 3%. A lot of 401k plans have done the same thing, where when they initially set up a 401k plan, for instance, where their employees are automatically enrolled, for whatever reason, the majority of companies, and states are looking at this too, select 3%. And when you look at some of the original work that was done, 3% was used as an example. I can't remember if it was the Department of Labor or EBRI that used it in an example, and for whatever reason, that just stuck. So we did research and to find out, well, what is that real point of pain where a participant in a retirement plan will say, wait a minute, that's just too much, I'm not going to do this anymore. So this research shows that between 6 and 24 months, if you take the auto deferral rate all the way from 3% and double it to 6%, you have actually the same or better participation rate in terms of people actually staying in the program. So what we have found and what we usually recommend in our research is don't start folks at 3% deferral, start them at 6%. Okay, and in most cases, there's going to be exceptions, but in most cases, you're going to have the exact same stick rate in terms of people actually staying in the program. Okay, now we're going to talk.
Can you explain that? Why is that?
I mean, that's a material difference in take home. Why is there virtually no difference? Were actually a slight increase in six. What do your studies tell you?
Good question. And I think when we started the study, and when I talked to Sloma about this, you know, we thought it would go down. I think most people thought it would go down. But the inertia is just so powerful that most people are not going to take the time to actually go to their HR, their payroll system, and say, no, I don't want to be at 6%. I want to be at 3 or something. There was a case recently, it was a chicken farmer, that I would say theirs came down more than I'd see, you know, than others, but it wasn't significant. So again, I think it's just, from all our studies, it's inertia is that powerful.
Did they try 10%? Or did they just
decide? There is a point of too much. Usually when we get around 10 and 12%, it's going to be too much. Okay. So no one knows the exact number, but I can't remember the study we did, but I think it was at 12 where it was a dramatic, no, it's too much. Mm-hmm. Now, well, I'm not going to, it's not in the presentation, but we also found that if you auto-increase, mm-hmm. We recommend auto-increasing at least 1% per year, but we found that doing it by 2% per year doesn't have a material difference either. So what we're recommending out there to the private sector, at least, is starting folks at 6%, auto-increasing them at 2% a year until they at least get to 10%. All right. So now we're going to talk about chocolate and bananas. And what does this have to do with retirement? So this is what we're talking about here is present bias. So the question that was asked, and again, we're not seeing on the picture, it would make a little more sense. But what happened is let's say you were given a survey before this session started, and you were asked, well, what kind of snacks do you want in the hallway? Do you want bananas, or do you want chocolate or candy or something? Most folks, 74% on this study, said, you know, I want something, a healthy snack, like a banana. Okay. But when the actual conference happened and we got to the present, is actually it reversed, whereas instead of 74% eating the healthy food, when the actual day got there and the conference went on, 70% of the folks ate the chocolate. Okay, so we all have good intentions, but a lot of times we don't follow our good intentions, and this is seen in the present bias. And so again, this kind of goes back to the auto increase in future increases. What we found is on another study, if you ask employees, well, listen, I know you don't want to save today, but would you opt to save tomorrow, maybe January 1st, or on your birthday, or when you get a pay increase? So what we found is most folks, if you give them an option to enroll at a later date when they get a pay increase, that will, you know, if you don't want to default them into it, you can allow them to auto-enroll at a future date, and that also works. Yes?
Okay. What's the percentage who auto-enroll at a future date once they say they're going to do it? Do they have to sign new paperwork later on or be reminded? Or they just
And that's key. That's a good question. That's key to it, because you want to make that process very, very simple. Literally, if you can send out a postcard that has a check the box, which is I want to either start next year or start on my payroll dates, and keep it as limited information as possible so they can check a box, send it in.
They do have to make another decision or chance to get out of it, though.
They do. Well, if you're defaulting them, they do. But not if you're allowing them just to enroll. So you're allowing them to enroll today or in the future. Hmm. And again, I know it'll be a little different, because I know you're going toward a non-ERISA plan. So with the folks that we've seen go down similar steps are, again, using a payroll deducted IRA where there's no employer match, and that seems to you know, make sure that's not an ERISA plan. Loss aversion. So now we've got a picture of monkeys and apples. And so what does this mean? So this is particular experiment was done where you gave a monkey one apple, and that monkey was very happy. He ate the apple, was a happy monkey. Coming the next day, you give the monkey, same monkey, two apples, but then you take one away, very upset. Okay, still has one apple, but now it's very, very upset. So humans, like animals, are adverse to loss. And there's a couple ways, you know, that we see loss. Number one, paying. You know, if you're telling me I need to save more and you start taking money out, well, again, we talked about a way around that is even though a employee or participant might see that as a loss, meaning saving money or increasing their savings rate, they actually psychologically see that as a loss. So again, timing that with pay increases helps offset it. And the other part where you have to be careful is as the folks approach retirement age. Not retirees and pre-retirees, as they get close to that retirement date, they're not only sensitive to losses, but they're hyper loss adverse. They do not want to see their lifetime, you know, habits of good savings habits and good investing habits put at risk in the last couple of years. So that's something else you need to, you know, as you, I know that's probably not topic for today, but as you go down and think about this, that, you know, as folks get close to that retirement date, it's something to take into account. So the last 90%, one-stop portfolios. So we know from our research about 90% of all participants in a 401k plan are what we call delegators. They are folks who say, you know what, I don't have either the time or I don't have the knowledge to make my own investment decisions. I don't understand it. I want someone else to do it for me. Now, I was a part, you know, as I said, I've been in this industry for over 20 years, and I remember the 1990s, I used to go out and do enrollment meetings. And I'll share this kind of mistake the 401k industry made with you. The theory back then was that we could educate every working American to be an expert at asset allocation investment so they can do it themselves. So we'd go out and give these one-hour educational meetings once a year and talk to employees about what a large cap growth fund is and a small cap and an international and a bond fund and how to mix them if you're conservative, moderate, aggressive, and how to do all this stuff. And we printed all kinds of materials. We did all kinds of meetings, and the impact was very, very little. So what we found is most people don't want to do surgery on themselves, and they don't want to make their own investment decision. They like the concept of, you know, one-stop shopping, some kind of you know, target date fund, if you will, and you'll see that's why the target date fund industry has boomed so much. Only about 9% are fine tuners, where they do want to do their own research, and maybe they do want to, you know, put more of their money in risky assets or less risky and play around with it. And then you got that top 1% that are customizers. You know, they almost want a brokerage window, if you will. And for so many years, I think our industry catered to that top 1% and the fine tuners. We made everything about them and not the other 90%. So our research shows, all right, let's take care of the 90% that are assuming that they're going to be taken care of. And by the way, the more you start going down this road of auto increase, auto default, the more it starts looking like a defined benefit plan where things are done for you instead of you trying to do everything yourself.
Can I get a question?
Yes.
Just looking at the commercials that the industry has out there that are on television all the time, what your anecdote and what this chart seems to show is that most of that is still aimed at the 1%.
Yes. If you're looking at any of the self-directed brokerage and all that stuff where they're picking stocks or mutual, yes, that's aimed at the 1%, the traders out there. Most people, and if you look at, don't want to do anything, if you look at most record-keeping studies of participants, only about 3% of participants of any given provider make any changes at all during the year. Most participants of a 401k plan don't even open their statements. I mean, once it's done, they just don't look at it, which is, in a way, it's good because a lot of them, especially the younger ones, they don't panic during down markets because they don't open their statements. So they do what they're supposed to. They stay in. But what this is showing is that most folks are served best by a one-stop solution like a target date fund. For the fine tuners, you know, they can be served by 5 to 9 core funds. And then for the customizers, you're really not building retirement plans for them. They can do stuff outside of a retirement plan. So again, behavioral finance, we talked about save more, save smarter. We're trying to optimize the participant outcomes in terms of how much retirement income they can ultimately have. We didn't talk about glide path or asset diversification, but that goes back, and again, you're probably not going to discuss it later, but I'm going to jump around just a little bit. What we found back in 2008 is we have about 40 different target date funds out there. They all have different strategies. Some have you at an aggressive point when you're tired. Some have you at a conservative point. So it's just trying to find the right one or ones when you get to that point that meet what you think the risk parameters are. Whether there might be multiple risks, but there is no right answer. There's not a wrong or right answer when it comes to target date funds. They all have different objectives. So try and find one that has the objectives that you're solving for. So what we're trying to, when you look at ultimately where we're going, in the 401k and DC world and the retirement world, we think that this save is like, if you compare it to an aircraft, helps the aircraft automatically take off. The auto increases allows that aircraft to fly higher. And then getting them into a target date fund or something like a target date fund smooths out that rise, so they're not hitting the turbulence, if you will. So that's where we are from a savings standpoint as an industry. I think the part that the industry is still trying to get smarter about is auto landing. And auto landing would be your retirement income. There's still really, outside of a defined benefit plan, that hasn't really been... I don't know if conquer is the right word or address is the right word, but we're not there as an industry in terms of having an auto landing, if you will.
Is that because or would you agree or not agree that the language of the industry is about now wealth management and not about how much you need for what you should expect for income and retirement?
Exactly. I mean, when you look at the timing of when DC plans, you know, came in, which were the early 80s, and DB plans started going out of favor. We've been in a period of the last, you know, over 3 decades, all about accumulating wealth. And not only participants, but advisors have not been well-versed at how do you turn that wealth into lifetime income that you're not going to run out of. And it's harder to – that's a harder planning session. Some studies show that's seven times harder to plan for income than it is to plan for accumulating wealth. So – and then there's – so there's a lot of discussion going in the industry. Is that going to be an auto feature? Is it not? Is that the time where they need to engage an advisor at that transition point in their career? Don't know. It's the industry is still debating that, on how much of that can be automated, how much is not. Ultimately, though, when you do get to that point of looking at investments, I can tell you that, you know, there's always this debate on how conservative or aggressive the investment should be. But one of the primary inputs and one that's going to make the biggest difference is going to be the savings rate. And I'll tell you what the industry assumes. I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it, but I'm just going to tell you the primary assumption is that the lower the savings rate, the more risky the participants should be invested. The lower the savings rate, the more risk they should take. I personally don't agree with that philosophy, but that's just how a lot of these computer models and financial models work, that when they're building these what they call glide paths that go into target date funds. So just want to throw that out there. There's going to be, as you go down this road, you'll see a lot of debate on that subject also. And again, I'm going to skip over all the assumptions unless there's questions.
Yeah, I have another question. Most mutual funds that I've run across, or I think it's pretty standard in the industry, have an initial investment amount,
mm-hmm.
and it can be from typically it's $250, $500, even $1,000 in some, and then for IRAs it might be half that amount. But still considerable mm-hmm. amounts. How much, if your studies reflect or have looked into it at all, how much do those initial investment rates turn people off and say, I can't afford $500 to get it even started?
Right.
So it's out of the, it's not part of, the, I'm not, I can't be part of the game.
Right. We have not done any studies on that. We're a mutual fund company, and we have share classes that we're allowed to waive the minimums on. I'm sure that if, in your findings, if you develop a program that you said, all right, the rules to be in the game is you can't have a minimum, I'm sure mutual fund companies would waive the minimum. When just as a side note, we were the investment advisor to the Nest Plan, which is the defined contribution over the United Kingdom. And you know, when you look at what they did, and you look at what some other states are kind of sort of doing, it's they mandated a plan on the front end. So there was a mandate that went in. And in the U.S., we're seeing, again, the work of some other states saying, okay, maybe it's every employer that has five employees or more, you know, has to go in a plan. Then they figured out, all right, what's the product offering after the mandate? And the state's going to have product offering. Private companies are going to have product offerings. How do you figure that out? And when we saw the U.K., what we're seeing there, you know, year to date, is about 20% of the folks are going with the UK plan, if you will, and about 80% are going with other providers. So just to give you a backdrop of what some other folks are doing. That's my prepared statements, unless there's other questions.
I have a question. So, Glenn, you talk a lot about auto-enrollment, auto-escalation. On the private plans you guys administrate, any of those ERISA?
Yes. So most of our ERISA plans, although a lot are not ERISA. I mean, we have a lot of 403B plans are set up. They're not ERISA, but they are set up to mimic the best practices of ERISA, just because there are some good things that came out of ERISA just from a best practices standpoint. So I've seen a lot of plans that are non-ERISA plans just mimic it, just because they like some of the best practices, and it helps them get better pricing too.
Thanks.
Could I go back to your last comment about your role with the UK plans?
Yes.
If I understood you correctly, that there was a mandate, everybody had to be in one.
Yep.
If they weren't, didn't already participate, or if the employer didn't already have one.
Right.
And you said the split was about 20% went with the mandated plan or went with the state-sponsored plan.
Right. So that what they had, they didn't want the state, for lack of a better word, to have the monopoly. So they said, all right, the state's going to have an option, and other companies can offer products too, and the employees pick what, you know, plan they want. And about 20% went with the state, and the other 8% went with the private industry offerings.
I had another question, and I might think of it again in 5 seconds.
Well, I'll sit in the back for a while.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Glenn. Unless anybody else had any. Bert, did you have a question?
That last statement, 20% went with the state plan, 80% opted for something from the private sector or something else, but they did it.
Right. So they did it. So because this is a mandate. So the first part, it was a mandate. So every employer had to offer something. And you know that, and then the employees could say, okay, I want to take the product that the state's offering, or no, I want to take a product that a private company's offering. So the actual employees made that decision on who
Thank
the
you.
Was.
And on the UK plan, that's at a country level, right?
Country level, yes, okay. Called Nest.
And I remembered my question.
Okay,
I think much of our discussion, while we're not saying it, The tendency is to be thinking of private sector for-profit employers, small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But Oregon has a large number of nonprofit businesses as well, not tax exempt, I guess is a better term.
Yeah.
Did you find in your consulting with the UK work, was there any requirement related to were the requirements for any employer, regardless of profit or nonprofit status, or is the requirement only the mandate only focused on for-profit businesses?
All right, good question. I wasn't part of that consulting. We were doing more the risk consulting on the state product, but I can tell you, you know, over here in terms of if you're looking at an IRA type product, you know, I don't think that would make a difference in the United States if you had some kind of automatic IRA option that, you know, when you think of it, and I used by way of background, I worked on the benefit side and benefit administration and payroll companies and all that kind of stuff. So from an administrative standpoint, when you talk to the ADPs of the world and the Paychexes of the world, they'll tell you that have some kind of auto IRA, where it's just like a direct deposit on a payroll system is the easiest way to set something up. And there, you really don't care if it's a for-profit or not-for-profit. And there's no employer contributions, so there's no administrative fees, there's no non-discrimination testing you have to do. All that stuff is what drives up the cost, is all this what they call non-discrimination testing. There's ADP, ACP testing, top-heavy testing, chemo. There's all this stuff that just goes away when you do some kind of auto IRA.
Ask a question about the state-run plan. Given that it was a mandate, what's the value proposition for the state-run plan? In the UK.
In the UK.
What? On what basis were they competing with the private sector?
Well, you know, they. The way I understand, again, I was not consulting on that. I'm strictly in the U.S., but colleagues of mine did. But the way I understand it is the state had their product, which they thought was the best product that they could use their purchasing power to put together. But then they also allowed, you know, any number of other companies, as long as they met certain minimum criteria, to also offer the product in that same vein. So, you know, there's proposals. You know, some folks, you know, they probably think they can do it pretty good at the UK, and but they didn't want to exclude competition, if you will.
Thank you. Curious.
Thank you. One more follow-up on that. I appreciate that you weren't directly involved, but if you have any information, if you could explain that a little bit more. When was the offering of the products to the employer or to the individual employee? In other words, did the individual employee, if there was a mandate, that meant the employer had to be involved.
Offer, right.
So did the employer say, here's the government plan, or here's...
Oh, how is the enrollment?
And here's three others.
Right.
Take your pick.
Right. You know, my guess is you know, you're in this plan now, and I'll pick an investment option.
Okay.
Or do you want to go with the state plan? Do you want to go with one of these other plans is how I understood it.
Okay.
And I know they had over a million folks enrolled in the first 3 months, and just anecdotally the numbers that were coming out.
And this was done without any match by the employer?
I don't know about that in the UK. I'm just saying in the my comments were in the US. If you were to do a payroll deducted IRA and you want it to be non-ERISA, then you would not want a employer match, because an employer match would probably make it ERISA.
You just maintain a simple IRA.
Simple.
Yeah. Glenn? It's a term we used before. So.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Unless there's any other issues for Glenn? Glenn, thank you. That was a great presentation.
We
appreciate it. Next up, we get a twofer. We get Dr. John Chalmers and Dr. Bill Harbaugh. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Perfect.
John is an associate professor of finance at the U of O, and Bill is a professor of economics at the University of Oregon. We welcome you here, and we appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us to be here today. So just a brief introduction. My name is John Chalmers. As Ms. Wheeler said, I've been at the University of Oregon since 1996. My background before that, I was in the public finance department for a large commercial bank for 3 years, sold municipal bonds. And then since I've been at the U of O, my primary research interests have been in the municipal bond market, mutual funds, and most recently I've done a lot of work with the Oregon PERS data as well as Oregon retirement plan data from the Oregon University System, using literally all the data that's out there on how people make retirement decisions. So I hope that I can provide some of that in some of those things we've learned from that research today. Bill, I'll let him introduce himself, but he's the brain guy, so he's going to tell us what we're all thinking. Okay, and so we'll get it set up, and then he shows all the cool pictures. I'm the boring guy.
That's why John's wearing the tie.
I have to try to look good. Okay, so if we start with kind of at the very building blocks of kind of how we think about these problems, and I saw a slide almost exactly like this in Glenn's slide deck. So basically, we start with people who need to build up their human capital. They need to get an education. They need to pay tuition. They probably take out student loans. They're probably spending more than they have in order to do that. That's a good thing. There's a lot of evidence that people that have a better education or more education have much better financial lives than those that don't. Then you have a career. Hopefully you pay off those debts that you ran up as a student. You save some of your money, and you make some good investment choices. Okay, and then and obviously that career path is hopefully a very long one. And then the last thing, and it's a very important one, is at retirement. What do you do? First of all, when do you retire? You know, how healthy are you? How long do you think you're gonna live? How much money do you need to have in order to survive, or at least have money as long as you survive? And then and there's a lot of evidence, both theoretical and empirical, that we really want people to annuitize their wealth at that point. And this is a study which isn't directly on the point of your committee, but that I recently did with the Oregon PERS folks, and saw kind of among these 40,000 retirees who choose to annuitize, who chooses to take lump sums, and why they do those things. And I think all of these parts are critical and potentially important areas where the state can help people make better decisions in all three of these dimensions. Okay, so but I'll focus on career today. So I think one of the most important things I can kind of do is just remind everybody, you probably already know this, but compounding investment returns are miraculous. So save $500 a month for 35 years. Assume 10% gross returns, the left-hand column. Okay, I have two plans. One charges you a point and a half a year, 1.5%. That's nothing, right? One of them charges you half a percent. At the end of those 35 years, you'll have wealth of $1.2 million if you've been paying 1.5% and earning 10%. If you've been paying a half a point, you'll have $1.66 million. It's a pretty big difference. I think it works out to be $371,000. Okay, that's what 1% matters. Okay. Now, if you earn a little bit more, so if you're more willing to take risk in your investment, let's say that now, and I'm going to focus on the right column. Actually, we have a pointer here. I don't know if I can. Yeah. So over here, we're going to assume 12% gross returns over the long run. 12% gross returns is about what the stock market has earned. So if we get people to invest in the stock market, that is a reasonable expectation. It may not actually happen, but it's a reasonable expectation. Again, we do the two charges. We end up with $2.1 million if we're paying the high fees. We end up with $2.8 million if we're paying the low fees. It's a lot of money. It's $500 a month. It's not based in percentages. You know, we could do it lots of different ways. But if we could get everybody to do something close to that with some of the methods that Mr. Dow was talking about, I think, obviously, with that much wealth, you can do a lot of retirement. So again, stock participation matters, and what I'm trying to do there is contrast 10 versus 12. We want people to put some of their money in risky investments if they can handle it. Second of all, fees matter a lot. Don't let anybody tell you 1% doesn't matter. 1% matters a lot. Okay? Yeah, when we're earning 12%, that 1% difference is $651,000. That's in your pocket instead of the financial advisor's pocket. Okay. So I think that's really important to remember, and it kind of highlights what has to happen to make things work. We have to make savings happen, and then we have to invest our savings well. So what are some of the options we have to make savings happen? Well, luckily, we actually have a lot of evidence, and Mr. Schwartz was kind enough to send along some of the ideas that you've already talked about in preparation for our presentation. And one of the things pointed out that you guys know a lot of this already, which is basically that defaults with opt-out provisions are miraculous. They work, and Mr. Dial's presentation pointed this out in the organ donation case as well as others. If you just say, this is what you're going to do, and if you don't want to do it, you don't have to, but you have to sign some papers. You get people to save. And there's, I'm going to talk about one study that kind of shows that, but it's one of hundreds. You can have matching plans. Matching plans work, not as well as defaults, but they are a nice feature. You can have education at a broad level. You know, people attain the highest level of education they can. That seems to work pretty well in improving people's financial outcomes. Education directly in finance. This is what you should do to save for retirement. I can't get my mother to do the right thing. Okay, so it's not easy to get people to kind of make those choices. I hold my mom's hand. I go down. And I say, we're going to buy an annuity for you today. And if I hold her hand and walk her all the way in the office and we look at them all, I can get her to do it. But absent that, it's really hard to kind of get that to work. Advice, good advice is great. It's hard to get unconflicted advice in the financial services industry, and there's a lot of noise in the financial markets, and so it's always hard to differentiate good from bad advice after the fact. You know, you could be unlucky, you could have gotten bad advice.
The way you explain that,
I'm going to talk a little bit more about the advice. Is that the one?
No. The under make savings happen, you have four items.
Yep.
The way it was explained suggests, and tell me if I'm hearing this correctly, that's actually a rank order of effectiveness.
I'm not sure. They're defaults are the best.
Okay.
Okay. We could argue about the others.
Okay.
That might be my rank ordering.
Okay.
The other, so advice, I'm going to talk a little bit more later. Invest savings well. So again, the point of this is we need to get some stock market participation for investors. If we get everybody to save a bunch of money, but then they just put it in a money market fund, which today earns 0.01%, we're actually not helping them nearly as much as we could if we could get people to take on some risk in their portfolios. So option A would be a low-fee diversified portfolios, as Mr. Dowell talked about, that, you know, 20 years ago he was trying to get people to set up their asset allocations in a reasonable way and account for their risk tolerances. I've been kind of trying to do that as a finance professor for about the same amount of time, and I think we both had similar success. I mean, it's, it's hard to get people who aren't really interested in finance to really think about those questions. Option B, is a well-defined default with opt-out provisions. So, and a well-defined default would be, in my mind, a low-fee target date fund. Again, very low fees. Target date funds are not all the same. They can be very, very different, so you need to be very careful in selecting what the menu of target date funds is. But the key is they're low fees, and people understand kind of what their plan is. Others, financial education, financial advisors, and I'll talk a little bit more about those on the next couple slides.
So why do you say target date funds are low fees?
They aren't all low fees. What I'm saying is you don't want to pick one with a high fee. You want to pick one with a low fee. You're not going to get any additional benefit for the high fee.
Thanks.
Education's a tough road to hoe. And here I'm going to just touch the tip of the iceberg with some of this, but there's a woman who's now at George Washington University, Anna Maria Lusardi, and her co-author, what's her name? First name?
Mitchell.
Olivia.
Olivia, that's it. Olivia Mitchell. And they've written hundreds of papers probably on financial literacy. These three questions, and I'm not going to read them all to you, but they ask this broad panel that happens over time of Americans these three questions. And maybe I'll just focus in on question number one. So question number one says, suppose you had $100 in savings account and the interest rate was 2% per year. After 5 years, how much are you going to have this account if you left the money to grow? More than 102? Exactly 102? Or less than 102? Now, of course, I'm not going to put anybody on the spot, but it should be pretty clear that if you're going to earn 2% a year, in the first year you earn the first $2, and after that you're going to earn compound interest on that $2. You don't even need to know the compound interest. You just need to know that 2% of 100 gets you to 102. And so how many people do you think? The other questions are similarly basic. Okay? Similarly basic. How many people get these all three right? 34%.
Wow.
Okay? So this is a tough road to hoe. We got a long ways to go to get people to understand pretty basic ideas. And this has been tested in lots of different places. And there's more data there that I don't need to go into, but for your information. Luckily, we did a survey of Oregon University System employees, and I'm happy to say that over 90% of the Oregon University System employees actually get all the questions right. And we actually asked a harder one, too. So there were four of them, and we got them all right. That's the good news, and that's in a paper that I wrote with John Reuter, who's now at Boston College. The bad news is, even though they get all the literacy questions right, they still do the same stupid things. Okay? So we got good news, bad news. So we'll try to be positive. So then I guess the next thing I want to talk about is defaults are kind of this. This thing that people found and really didn't believe these results at first. And this paper by Bashir's, Choi, Labson, and Matrian, they have a whole bunch of papers that are related. It's a little hard to keep them all straight, honestly. But the first paper was a paper by Matrian and Shea, actually in 2001, that basically found this default effect. And I'm not showing that. But basically, this is almost the same picture that Glenn showed us in a different format. And what this shows is these red and blue lines are basically, the gray line is we don't have automatic enrollment. The red and blue lines are we do. And notice basically that we get from 60, you know, call it 70% enrollment if people have to choose to be part of this after 18 months, to basically 100% enrollment. And it doesn't matter whether it's 3 or 6%. Everybody enrolls and just does what they were told to do or what was set up as the default. So I think that's exactly where you set the 3 or 6%. It's clear you want to set it at least 6 and maybe go a little higher if you can. But this, I guess this evidence just suggests that there's a lot of pretty low-hanging fruit here to get people to save. And I might... before I step to this slide, I might add, I was on a committee last year for the Oregon University System that led to passage of a bill that changed some of the retirement rules in the optional retirement plan. And one of the changes in those rules was that we have a match now. So there's an 8% contribution and a 4% match plus. One of the things I had asked the chair of our committee was, you know, why don't we default people into the 4% contribution so that everybody takes advantage of this match? And the answer, and I never kind of delved any deeper, was that the Oregon state law doesn't allow us to do that. Things like that are things that if this committee could help, that's in the public sector, but in the private sector, provide the ability to put those defaults into place, those would almost certainly improve savings behaviors. Okay. Financial education advice. Education can help.
Can I interrupt for one second?
Yep.
How important was the match? Once you switched to a match, could you measure different results?
Work in progress because we just changed the match.
Okay. Do you have any early non-confirmed results to share with us?
It literally hasn't gone into effect yet. So we're going to collect the data.
Very good.
Report back.
Okay.
Matches don't work perfectly, though, and there's some other studies I know of in the finance literature where people leave money on the table is what a lot of these studies find. People won't earn 100% return by contributing the money and then getting it matched. We don't know why, but if you defaulted them into it, I would venture to say that we'd get similar results to what you get in the other default studies.
Got it. Thank you.
Naturally, there's some studies, Ted, showing that, you know, our standard default or standard match has either been like a 1% to 4 or a half a percent. You know, first three are 1%, and the next three or four are half a percent. What people are talking about now and what research is starting to show is, you know, if you did smaller percentages but did a longer duration, so you got up to your 10%, you know, you could eventually get people to hopefully participate more.
Thanks, Herb. Appreciate it.
Okay, so education's help. When it's about finance, it's proven kind of marginally effective.
Within your
financial advisors, I've done quite a bit of work on this with co-authors, Dan Bergstresser, who's now at Brandeis, myself, and Peter Tufano, who was at Harvard at the time and now is the dean at Oxford University. And then this paper that I referred to already with John Reuter, who's at Boston College. What we found is advisors do some good things. For example, fewer investors are in bad default investments like a money market when they have an advisor. So the advisors move people from a money market into stock market type investments. They also have more international diversification, we found. And this was a study of virtually all mutual funds. And we looked at them by their distribution channel, whether they were directly sold, like a Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, or whether they were sold through broker channels. So they did find some things. But we did find that incentives matter, as economists would expect, and advisors respond to those incentives. And so actively managed mutual funds charge investors more and usually pay advisors more than, say, a low-cost index fund would. And brokers put their clients in those. That's where they get paid the most. There's little evidence that advisors pick better performing mutual fund investments for their clients. In fact, I mean, that little is being kind there. I mean, I would almost say no evidence. And a big part of that is just the fees they charge. There's a big fee difference. That makes a big difference in performance, and it's not positive. There's little evidence that advisor clients recover those fees that they pay their advisors in terms of better investment performance. That is a fee for services. And kind of the point of my second slide was to show you that's a $600,000 fee, given the example I gave. So we have some evidence in this paper on the optional retirement plan in the for the university system in Oregon that a well-specified target date fund over our sample period would have outperformed by dramatically the advised channel investments that people made, and even outperformed the do-it-yourselfers who were basically picking their own mutual funds in the other provider.
I'm sorry, what's a target date fund?
Yeah, I was going to ask
that. Okay, so there's target date fund, life cycle fund. All of those are basically funds where you tell me your age, and Fidelity has a specific fund for the year you retire, and they'll assume you retire when you're 65. So they'll have the 2045 fund.
Got it.
And if you put all your money in that fund, that's a reasonable thing.
So it has your takeoff and your cruising, and then it has your, presumably at the end, an annuity or some strategy.
Yep. And this was exactly what Glenn was talking about. Yep. It's a product that is now taken off, and they're very different across different companies, and so it's important to kind of think carefully about setting up the right set of target date funds or life cycle funds for a plan. And I think that would be an important job that any plan that came out of the state would want to think about very carefully.
Thank you. So for some of us, there's no such thing as a negative target date.
Well, the good news is, mortality rates have dropped dramatically, so you're going to live a long time. So actually, your investment horizon at retirement doesn't go to zero. I mean, it goes to 30 or 40, 50 years, hopefully long.
50 years.
Harley, you have a question.
John, can I take a couple questions on your research? So do you guys look at like a managed option at all with advisors or?
It is a managed, I mean, it's not a, I mean, the option, I'm not going to tell you the name of the company, but it's a company that has an individual financial advisor that works with the university employee to design their portfolio from a set of about 70 or 80 different mutual funds.
And on the research that you guys are pulling from nationwide?
No, these are all in Oregon. So these are
all this. Okay.
So these are just Oregon University System employees for the second paper. The first paper, Briggs Stresser, Chalmers, Tofano, that's nationwide.
Okay.
So that's all mutual funds. We had a sample of thousands of mutual funds.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
So absent advice, what happens? So this is the question that we got asked a lot when we talked about our paper. What happens if we take an advisor away to the people who really don't know what to do or are just kind of frozen about making investment decisions? Well, we find, not surprisingly, and I think I said this already, that users of advice are younger, less educated, have lower salaries, so we'll call them less experienced and less education, and are more likely to choose advisors. So that's kind of the sample in the Oregon University system who's choosing advisors. In the OUS system, we kind of have this nice experiment that happened, which helped us out. The advice channel was removed from the set of possibilities for new employees. Actually, it was in 2007. Okay, so they no longer had that option. And so what we can look at is we can say, what do those people do that we know we can predict who they are? Because we've learned already who chooses the advice channel. And so we can statistically make estimates of who's going to go into the advice channel, take the advice channel away, and say, what do those people do now that that advice channel is gone? And what we found is that they take the default investment. So if we design a good default investment, we're going to end up with people who are both saving. If we define a good default savings rate and then we define a good investment for those savings, we can expect that those less sophisticated, less educated folks are going to put their money in a good spot as long as we picked a good spot. The good news for policy, as long as the plan administrator chooses a default investment that makes sense, and I think these target date type solutions have proven to be pretty effective, then we can make a big difference in the savings behaviors and savings outcomes for individuals. And I say here, a money market fund would be a bad default. A low fee, well-diversified target fund, in my opinion, would be a good default. Just to transition to Bill's section, which will be the interesting section, decades of financial economics research has led to the simple advice that you should be a disciplined saver, you should start young, you should invest what you're comfortable with in risky investments, you should keep your fees low, don't chase past performance, or the latest tip, buy low-fee index funds. There's probably 98% of all finance papers written would tell you that. There's a few outside the box. And be well diversified across assets and around the world. So you want to hold a diversified portfolio. Now, it's a puzzle for economists and behavioral economists that we have a really hard time getting people to follow the straightforward advice. It literally, I could give, I could sit down with my mom and tell her this in 20 minutes, and she still won't do it.
But would she agree with it, though?
Yeah, she'd agree with it. She just can't get her to make the phone call. So she has since then, though. I mean, I worked hard, though.
I guess my question is,
she loves me.
Do people are readily accepting and understand the information, but just for some reason don't do it? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's what happens. I think people don't dispute that what I have to say is supported by real data and real evidence. But I think, I think it does require a
motivation.
Some action.
Yeah.
Back to your comment.
So I think the good news is there's hope with these defaults, both in terms of getting the savings rates right and getting investment choices to be reasonable ones. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Bill, who can help us figure out how people think.
Okay, so thanks. So I'm a I've been at the University of Oregon since 1995. I started out as a public economist interested in charitable giving. Since then, I've done experimental research, actually a bunch of experiments with economic behavior of children, including school children. And that research shows that children's choices are just about as rational as adults' choices are. So you can kind of take that either way. Either children are very rational or adults aren't so rational. Mm-hmm. Since then, I've started doing a new kind of research, which is called neuroeconomics. And that research involves using techniques from neuroscience to look inside people's brains as they make economic choices. And so I'll tell you a little bit about that sort of work, which I think you'll see is pretty closely related to the issues that you're interested in, although I do have to say that it's, you know, academic work. It's not applied. It's not designed to specifically address the questions of retirement savings, although it does have lots of implications for them, I think. So just sort of reviewing the basic idea of behavioral economics, there's the old kind of economics, which is neoclassical economics, and this kind of economics assumes that people are rational, that they're pretty knowledgeable. They may make mistakes about things, but they're not systematic mistakes. It's just kind of random errors. Everybody gets something wrong, maybe because you don't invest enough time thinking about the decision. Maybe it's totally rational not to think too hard about a decision that's not particularly consequential, or which the consequences will be a long time off in the future. So neoclassical economics starts with this idea that people are really optimizing agents, and basically they do a pretty good job at it. The alternative economic model is the behavioral economics model, and that's the model. It's really derived from psychology, and psychologists are always interested in the mistakes, the strange kinds of decisions that people make, and that's how I had a lot of influence on economics in the last 20 years, in part because we've seen evidence that people are making significant economic decisions, important economic decisions, and not just making errors, but making systematic kinds of errors. And that makes us think that the rational model might not be the best way or the only way to think about how people make economic choices. And interestingly, a lot of this research comes from work in retirement decision making. So I'm going to start by talking about what we call time inconsistent decisions. And the basic idea here is that when you ask people, you know, you tell people, you sort of do the education thing that John's talking about. You tell them, explain to them, you've got to start saving for retirement now. People will say, okay, I get it. I plan to start saving for retirement. I'm going to do that next year. Next year comes around. You ask them again, and they give you exactly the same answer. Yes, I plan to start saving for retirement next year. Okay? It's very much like when you ask somebody, you tell them they're a little bit overweight, you tell them they need to go to the gym, and their answer is, yes, I'm going to go to the gym and start working out next month. Next month comes around, they're still not doing it. So what's interesting about those decisions is not that people are putting this off. It's that they're thinking that they're going to start saving or start working out, and then they don't. And they do that repeatedly. So that's a sort of irrationality that really bothers economists, because it looks like a systematic mistake that people are making. We're not worried about mistakes. We're not worried about people deciding that they don't want to exercise. But we are bothered by the idea that at one point people say they want to save for retirement. They fully plan to, but then they don't do it over and over again. Okay? So that is called a time-inconsistent decision. And people talked about this for a long time. There were some experiments that showed evidence of this. I think we saw the banana and chocolate example. That's kind of a perfect example of it. This is a more consequential one. What happened about 15 years ago is that economists started learning how to use the techniques from neuroscience to image people's brains while they were making economic decisions. Not necessarily real decisions about their retirement behavior, for example, but sort of made-up experiments where you're giving people a choice about whether they want money now or money later. It's an economic experiment, so there's really money on the table. So the experiment I'll talk about in a second, people really are making decisions about when they will get money, how much money they will get, and they're really paid those amounts of money. And that's necessary because if people are just making hypothetical decisions, it's not necessarily the same as the decision they will make when there's really money on the table. So I'll talk a little bit about neuroeconomics, the method here. I don't want to go on too long about this because I'm absolutely obsessed with the technique that you use here. It's very interesting. What you do, most people nowadays have had an MRI scan. And an MRI, you go into the scanner, and essentially it's a very powerful electromagnet with some radio coils hooked up to it. And what that scanner does is it allows you to make a three-dimensional image of a body part. And it works because the protons and the molecules in your body are spinning around and they're affected by the magnet that you're in. You bombard it with some radio waves and you can tell the molecular composition of different parts of your body. Okay? There's no way this is interesting to economists. You know, we don't really care what's inside people's body. We care how much they save, but not what's inside their body. What happened after the physicians figured out how to use MRI, though, was it turned out that there's a difference in the image that you get from blood with oxygen in it and blood without oxygen in it. Again, it's a stretch to see how to get from that fact to economics. But, of course, what's happening inside your brain when you think is that your neurons are sending electrical signals to each other. Those electrical signals are actually very energy intensive. A large fraction, when you're just sitting still, a large fraction of your body's energy is devoted to keeping your brain working. Okay? The more the electrons fire, or the neurons fire, the more energy the brain needs. And because the brain is such an energy sink, it has evolved to supply the blood directly to the areas where the neurons are firing and nowhere else. It doesn't want to waste any of that energy. So what that means is you can use this MRI machine and you do what's called a functional MRI scan. Sorry. And by doing you are able to get a reading of the ratio of oxygenated to deoxygenated blood in little parts of the brain. And you can repeat this and do it every 2 seconds. So now you have a three-dimensional image of the brain taken every 2 seconds. And what you're measuring is which parts of the brain the person is using when they're thinking about something or making a decision. Okay? Now you combine that with an economic decision, and you can get some evidence of how people are making choices about economic issues. So this next slide is just a kind of crude example of what the brain looks like. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt. In the interest of time,
sure.
And I'm sure people may have questions about this. Could I get you to limit it to about 7 more minutes?
Sure.
Great. I appreciate it.
Okay. So this is an example of the brain, and essentially what's happened is that you have these interior parts of the brain which are essentially devoted to making emotional decisions, and then you have prefrontal cortex, which is devoted to making rational kinds of decisions. Okay, I can get the next one. So that is the emotional area of the brain there, and then the next one. These would be areas that are more involved in making sort of conscious, rational choices. So the red area for quick decisions, the blue area for contemplative decisions. So here's the experiment. This was done in 2004. It's a classic experiment. You give people two decisions while they're in the scanner and while you're imaging their brain like this. The first decision, you ask them, okay, I want you to make a choice. You can have $20 right now, or right when you get out of the scanner at least, or you can have $30 next month. So that's a pretty good rate of return. And people think about it. But the temptation of the immediate $20 is pretty strong, and most people say, I'll take the $20 right now. Then the other kind of decision you show them is you have a delayed choice. So you have a choice of $20 next month or $30 in 2 months. So there's no way you're getting the money right now. The only question is whether you wait 1 month or 2 months to get it. What people generally answer for the first question, they say, okay, sorry, the numbers are wrong here, but they say, I'll take the $20 right now for the first choice. They can't avoid that temptation. For the second choice, they say, actually $30. I'll wait for 2 months to get the $30. In both cases, you're waiting a month, you're getting $10, but you can't wait when the money is on the table. You can wait when both decisions are delayed, right?
That's interesting.
Okay, so now that's just an experiment. The interesting part is, when to me, when you combine it with the brain evidence, you find that people are actually using two different neural networks to make these two different kinds of decisions, the ones with no delay, the immediate ones, and the delayed ones. So here's an example of what we're calling the limbic system, or the emotional part of the brain. And that doesn't show up as well as it can. But basically, you can see these colored areas, and yellow and a little bit of orange. And those are the parts that are activating when the person is facing the choice of money right now. Okay. Then if we go on to the next slide, you can see this is more the analytic brain. So these are the parts of the brain that evolved later in humans. Even lizards have a limbic system inside of them, but only humans have the prefrontal cortex. And this area of the brain is more active when you're making the decision about money next month or money 2 months from now. Okay, so there's no money on the table for today. Both these decisions are delayed. And what this paper is showing is that when both the decisions are delayed, you tend to use more of the analytic, reasoning, human part of the brain than you do when the money's on the table right now. Okay. So even more interesting than that, you can actually use the degree of activation in these areas to predict what kind of decision people will make about the case where there's $20 on the table right now. And the people who show more activation in these emotional areas are less likely to be able to defer gratification, save the money. And the people who show more activation in the analytic areas are more likely to do that. So if you go on, the way economists think about this, we use game theory to think about it, and it's almost as if there are two different people inside your brain. You know, it's kind of like the good angel and the devil on your different shoulders, and they're duking it out to decide what you're going to do. So when it comes to retirement decisions, we would like to encourage or to give the advantage to the decision-making process that uses the rational cortical parts of the brain rather than to the part of the brain that makes emotional decisions. And so when you, the work that you've heard from John today shows all these examples of how you get people to agree to commit to retirement savings. And there are basically two ways to do it. One is to pose the question in such a way that the decision is delayed, right? So you're making a decision about 2 or 3 months in the future, not about consumption right now. And of course, then the other way to do it is to cut out the brain entirely and force them to do the savings, or to kind of trick them into doing it with the default approach that people have been advocating. So the other parts of this, you know, is pretty simple. You don't want to overtax. You don't want to give the advantage to the limbic system, to the emotional system. So you want to make the decisions simple, unemotional kinds of decisions. And I think the default one is a good example of that. You want to make people commit, as you're saying. So that really cuts out the ability of the limbic system, the emotional system, to get involved in making these decisions. So the plans that people have talked about, where you commit to a small amount of savings now and that it automatically grows over time, that means you're making the decision for the future. You're making it today, but you're making it for your future consumption. And that's much easier for people to use than the cortical parts of the brain and make that decision rationally. So that's really the sort of news that I have from neuroeconomics that I think is relevant to the kinds of decisions you're going to be facing. I hope it's helpful. I hope you don't use too much of your emotional brain. Consider it.
Well, that's fascinating. Any questions?
Yes, sir. Without getting too far afield, how much do... Was there any testing when people were under stress on their choices, or does what you presented account for that? So if somebody is a very low income, for example, and the stress is on meeting the bills and paying the rent and feeding their kids.
That's a great question. I don't know of any work that specifically looks at that with retirement savings, but I have seen experiments where they give people mild electrical shocks when they make decisions, and you can imagine what that does. They focus on the pain rather than on using their thought processes.
We tried an experiment which
frankly didn't work out so well, but where we had the spouse of the person in the scanner watch and not watch when they were making financial decisions, but these weren't huge financial decisions.
So that adds a little bit of stress for many people.
So one of your other relevant resources here is talking about gender differences.
Yeah.
Do you see major differences in the way women are making decisions versus men, particularly as it relates to retirement?
There's a lot of work on that. A lot of it has to do with risk-taking behavior. Mm-hmm. And so many people will claim that men are more likely to take risks than women and therefore more likely to invest in stocks than in bonds and therefore more likely to have large assets later in life. I don't know if that's really true. The most interesting paper I've seen of this really goes back to the point about managed funds versus mutual funds. And it compares individual people who invest in individual stocks, men and women, and looks at their trading portfolios and finds that men are extremely overconfident about their ability to pick individual stocks. And so they, overconfident is the word, not correctly confident, but they believe they're better at it than they really are. And so they buy and sell stocks too often, and the investing companies get the commissions off that. Women buy stocks, hold them, which is exactly the correct thing to do when it comes to investing. And so they, actually women tend to get higher returns in this one paper at least than men do.
Yeah. Bert?
This is boy, it took me an hour to come up with my savings thing there. It must have taken you years. It would be interesting to see the gender changes if it was ever part of a classroom fourth grade exercise to keep some records over a period of time to see, you know, if the females did it differently, percentages and deferred gratification or whatever. I enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you.
That was interesting. Any other questions? Dr. Chalmers, Dr. Harbaugh, thanks so much. This was really fascinating material. We appreciate your time. Thank you. So we're going to spend the balance of our time, the next 30 minutes, based on what we have in hand so far. I'd ask Dick if he could take sort of a first stab working with Jan to identify very clearly what it is that we've been asked by the legislature to provide, and that's on one sheet of paper here under, it's just labeled HB 3436. And I've asked Jan to take a stab between this meeting and the next meeting to put some bullet points underneath those specific action items that the legislature had asked for us. That's just a tracker for us to make sure that we're actually hearing expert testimony on issues that the legislature had asked us to further investigate or that we have at least had discussions on. And then I asked Dick to take a first swing at what is effectively action item I through L. There's a little bit of fuzziness there, but these are sort of the broad construct issues that we've heard discussed. Portability, mobility, simplicity, auto-enroll, auto-escalate, you know, the mechanics of various plans that we've heard discussed. And I asked Dick to put together what I guess I will call a very loose trial pony for conversation purposes, just so we can get those issues out on the table and have conversations about them, see where we have agreement, see where we have disagreement. Again, we're not voting on anything today. I just want to have, I want to begin the conversation today so that we're teed up to have a very detailed, thorough conversation and some potential votes in our August meeting. And so with that brief introduction, I'm going to turn it over to you, Dick, and let you carry the conversation from this point since you did the lion's share of this effort.
Well, what I've done is break this into several general categories. First, with the characteristics, the kinds of things that we've heard from the various people who've spoken and reflected to some degree again, or to a large degree again, in today's presentations. The first thing is that we're asked in the bill to find ways of recommending increasing or enrolling people in retirement savings. And it occurred to me, and I've mentioned other questions, that what we're talking about is all Oregonians who do not have access, is the way I interpret that. And so I identified this as the among the characteristics that it should be able to reach any employee, any worker, anywhere in Oregon, and who does not have access where they're employed or may be eligible at some later date but currently doesn't have access to any kind of retirement savings program. That automatic enrollment be included, and that there be an automatic escalation feature to some amount that's left blank, that be part of our discussion. That there be some avenues, for example, the Department of Revenue could modify its online otter system or whatever the, apparently there's a revision in taking place that will replace otter to make it convenient for reporting and transmitting the payroll deductions for the participants. That their accounts are portable, that there be regular individual reports available to each of the participants, and that there's no required employer contribution. Under compliance issues, we've had extensive presentations on ERISA, both from a representative of the Treasurer's Office in California and what they're searching for, and from ERISA representatives themselves. And Treasurer Wheeler suggested earlier that it might be reasonable for us to recommend or to consider that all those states that are investigating these kinds of programs get together in a manner of speaking, figure out what the questions are that need to be asked, and ask them collectively to ERISA and get responses, understanding that each of the states might be have slight variances in what the program is that is being proposed, but that it would make sense financially, at least for each of the states, to pool the resources instead of each independently spending the large sum of money or some sum of money to get the same, essentially the same questions answered. So that would address the compliance issues by designation of some agreeable legal counsel, because I think we heard that there, even the ability to frame the questions correctly requires some legal expertise in order to present the correct questions for answers to ERISA, and that we get appropriate technical assistance from state agencies such as Revenue and Employment Department, who have to deal with some of those requirements. Under governance and management, that there be some tax-exempt entity, whether tax-exempt is the correct way to identify it, and under what section is part should be part of our discussion, but that it be established to govern and direct the program. The in the list of things that the task force cannot do is place any liability or other responsibility on the state for guarantees of returns for operation, the way I read those. So this would create some body, some board of N members. That's self-perpetuating board that suggestion here is representing private for-profit entities, tax-exempt entities, the legislature, and the Oregon Investment Board, the Office of the Treasurer, and that the board oversee the development and operations of the management of the plan, that there be appropriate investment and fund management policies, depositories, contracting with an investment fund manager, compliance with reporting requirements, and then periodic market analysis to help refine the program and its delivery, its any advertising for it, and education. That this will all require some kind of transition. And this actually surprised me when I reread a couple months ago, but this task force continues, sunsets in January of 2017. We heard the experiences of California and their effort to create an enterprise, which is a sort of a phase two or second level of trying to move their program. And it seemed that since the task force is formed, we're all here, we've been through this part at least, that it would make some sense to leave the remaining questions to this task force so it would continue to operate in the transition period from where we are today to some program that we're yet to define or recommend being actually in place and enacted by the state. That's the first stab. That would include in the transition taking the best that's been learned from other states, recommending and evaluating incentives such as marketing and technical assistance that could support employers, continue to address questions that arise in an implementation or in any of the recommendations that we may be making, and then engage legislators as appropriate for any legislation that may be needed to push our recommendations forward.
So, and thank you for that, Dick. I appreciate it. That was very thorough, and it's a great, I think, first take on what's been a lot of information that we've been fed with fire hose. Just by way of context, the legislature will be updated by us in September on where we are. And so we're hoping to give them as much of a thoughtful, truncated, but relevant data dump in September, and then we'll be asking them for additional guidance in terms of where they would like to see us go next. And I am assuming that there will be some effort amongst some legislators to introduce legislation this session, but I don't know that to be a fact. And so I asked Dick to do this in the spirit of getting the ball as far as we can get it, and then we'll ask for further guidance in September in terms of what they think the next steps are, the people who helped push this through the legislative process. Comments? Do you want to just go through this?
I have a thick skin.
Take it from the top? Or?
I'll make one comment. I want to please commend Dick and especially Jan. I got this at 9 o'clock last night from Jan. I mean, talk about a dedicated public servant.
Thank you.
Especially that's because I gave her some extra stuff to do yesterday, so she had to work really hard to get it done.
Yeah.
She has done a great job. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you. So does this make the assumption that we would then have something ready to implement or already implemented by the time this task force sunsets, including a board or whoever that would be overseeing that program? I'm just curious on timing, what the hope would be.
The way I see it is that we would lay out the recommendations written with some context from all the information we have wrapped around it. That would be the form of the report. And the recommendations, if this were acceptable, would say we'll stay in business and oversee these other elements so that by the time this task force sunsets, there'd be something in place.
My assumption, and this is based only on my own perspective, I've not pulled this deeply, that the legislature set us here in the middle of July to study these issues with the anticipation that they will be acting on something. And my assumption is further that there, whatever it is, will be heavily informed by the conversations we have and the research that we've conducted in support of their legislative asks. Whether or not it will actually be implemented, I could see a scenario whereby they pass legislation asking for whatever the next phase is, the creation of a board, additional studies. From my own personal perspective as treasurer, I would be reluctant to implement a plan without the ERISA questions nailed down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from my perspective, that is a key issue that has to be addressed in the near term, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. But we could have, for example, a board. We could have legislation that empowers a board to begin a process, even if we didn't have the ERISA question answered. But we could start to formulate what our next step would be in broader terms.
Yes.
Yeah. So we don't have to wait.
So you could, but I guess one of the questions I had, and you know, Richard, I really appreciate you calling out what we weren't supposed to do as a task force. So I thank you for doing that. But when I read that governance and management, by definition, that is liability in some of those areas. So picking funds, opens up a potential Pandora's box. And so those are things we'd have to just, actually talk through and make sure that we weren't taking on liability. And then also making sure that there's, that board doesn't cost anything to the state, which was also one of the other rules that, they asked us to stay away from. So those are things that just quickly came to my mind as you went through it.
We had a conversation on our team this morning, informal conversation about how do we answer the ERISA questions. California came and presented. They created, I believe it was a 501c3, but don't quote me on that. They created a completely separate entity that has the capacity to fundraise. They said they were trying to raise $1 million, the lion's share of which would go to ERISA attorneys in the private sector to help them formulate the questions to the Department of Labor. And being the inherent cheapskate that I am, I was trying to figure out how we could latch on to their good fundraising skills down there in Hollywood. And given that a lot of our questions are going to be very similar to the questions they ask, it could be appropriate for us to ask the legislature for support. We had a conversation with somebody from the Legislative Fiscal Office. They don't have specific ERISA support. I don't know if the Department of Justice does. I don't know to what degree, if any, the legislature would be open to us engaging them directly or whether they would provide us a budget. I just don't know. They're waiting for our guidance and a potential ask. And it just seems to me, based on the conversations we've had in this room, those ERISA and DOL issues loom large far as our ability to actually implement something. And if we want to do it, we've got to address those questions.
We do.
Hopefully sooner rather than later.
I think like what Glenn said earlier, I mean, definitely when you start talking about plan designs, when you talk about auto enrollment and auto escalations and opting out versus opting in, you're right in the face of DOL, right? And you're right in the face of ERISA. So, we got to get those questions answered one way or another and what they're...
So could we start with some of the what I'll call the low-hanging fruit? And maybe I'm completely wrong about this, but it seems like we've heard a lot of redundant testimony from a variety of different experts. As we look at the way Dick outlined this, and again, Dick, I'm very appreciative if you're taking the first effort here. Could we go through this just paragraph by paragraph, particularly on the characteristic side? Is there anything people object to or that strikes them? Is there any disagreement that if the state were to create, sponsor, incentivize, encourage a retirement savings tool, is there any disagreement that it should be portable from employer to employer? I mean, it seems like stuff like that sort of low-hanging. Am I wrong? Is there anything in here that is not low-hanging that people would like to have a conversation about?
Chair?
Yes, please, Ann.
I know that one of the concerns that I've heard raised about the need to support people's ability to save for retirement is that people who are not currently in the workforce because of caregiving roles aren't in the paid workforce need to be able to save also. So it's not clear to me that there is a provision in this that says in the auto payroll deduction that if you don't have payroll deduction because you don't have pay but you have the will to save that you can get in on this too. And I think that's, if we are looking to help particularly women retire in a reasonable position, we got to add something to that effect.
Excellent. And we should also, and I've asked Jan to do this, to keep a running list of technical questions like that are important questions that will come up, and we've hit a bunch of them. That's a great one. Another take on that, California, I think, limited their strategy to employers with five or more employees, if I remember that. I may be off by one employee on that, but I think it's five or more employees. Then the question would be, well, if you do that, then what happens to the employees who aren't, or what happens to employees who start with a larger company that has a retirement plan, then they move to a small one that doesn't? There's a lot of unanswered questions that have to be, that are technical questions that we'd have to address and that the legislature would ultimately want to know more about. And so I'm proposing we also keep a running list of these questions. But that's a good point, Ann.
The question I had was actually the very last one. It says there will be no required employer contribution. But I wonder if we can confirm whether a voluntary plan on the part of the employer, like a side account that has a match, I see it both as something to encourage the employee retention issue, but also the potential to encourage the employee to continue in the program, to not opt out. But it would mean that there would be some way that the employer would know whether the employee, how much they're contributing and that they're still contributing. Just, so that's kind of a minor technical point, but I think there would be value in looking at how that might interlace with what we're doing.
But if I understand you, you're saying that if an employer has some sort of savings program for retirement for employees, but this program, a program like this was in place, and the employer wanted to allow people to sign up for it, is that?
Well, what I'm saying is that
so they would be covered.
We currently have a plan for our employees. Frankly, it would not have, in my opinion, the same heft for my employees that something like this would have. So what I would frankly do is, you know, this says employed who are without access to an employer-sponsored retirement. If it meant being able to enroll our employees in something like this, I don't think I would have an employer-sponsored retirement plan. There it seems to me their potential would be much greater in this, but I would like to have something for the employees. See, the problem is with the ERISA, it can't be tied.
Right.
And so it have to be totally separate. It can't be mingling. So that's all I'm saying is a way to have the advantage of both, to have the employees, my employees, have the advantage of what a program like this might be, but also be able to participate. All this says is they won't be required to, but I want to make sure that there's a way that I can if I want to.
It seems to me that would be independent.
Well, and it's possibly that's the only way it would be, is totally independent.
Well, that an employer could still have programs.
Yeah.
An employee could have, question.
So
is
that
this
may
a
be
generally
the
available program?
That may be the way to leave it.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Or, you know, that's part of the ask in the request for guidance from the Department of Labor. And yeah. I like that it's really forefronted that we need to really find out an answer to that as soon as possible, and to the extent we can pool with others who will have essentially identical questions,
yes.
I think we should do that. But I think finding out answers to that as quickly as possible, even if it means fundraising, I don't know quite how we do it, is crucial, because if we're going to be bringing something forward to the legislature in January 2015, it seems like we have much greater strength.
Well, I have a strong preference.
Totally.
And my preference is, you know, the legislature has been a partner in this, and a good partner, and they've gotten the ball rolling on it. And I think we should express our preferences in terms of what we think makes sense. We don't have to reach a consensus. I mean, I'm okay if everybody doesn't agree on everything. I think that's fine, and I think that's intellectually honest. But if we're going to get to the next step of answering the questions about, okay, here's our preference, and it makes a package, and it potentially achieves the objectives of the legislature. Now the question is it legal? I really don't want the legislature to simply dump that back on this committee and say, go out and raise a bunch of money to answer the question. I think the legislature should provide us with the resources to be able to do the work that they need us to do. That's my personal preference. So I don't necessarily want to capitulate on that point just yet.
I'm good.
Not to be a naysayer, but so two things that come to my mind is we spent a lot of time early on talking about small employers, and we don't seem to have gone away from that into more of a, just a state plan. And so, you know, I am concerned that we jumped so far from one extreme to another extreme without having enough discussion about that. I think there are still some ways to incentivize our small employers to put a plan together. We talked about the simple IRA earlier today. You know, there's if what we're really trying to do is help Oregonians and save more than they're doing today, there are ways that we can help incentivize that without making a huge program and taking on a burden of costs.
Harley, could I impose on you?
Yep.
And I'd be delighted to help you with this.
Okay, Ted.
So it's not just me putting this on you. For our next meeting, or hopefully prior to our next meeting, would it be possible for you to do what I will call an outline report identifying what you think some of those best strategies are? And you can certainly employ the assistance of anybody on this committee to help with that, because I'd like to have the opportunity to fully flesh that out.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily see them as mutually exclusive from the work that Dick has done here, but I think it's an important component. We certainly heard testimony from some of the small business folks here in this room and elsewhere that I think deserves to be honored.
Fair enough.
Other thoughts? Does anybody have issues with auto enroll? I personally am persuaded by the research that I've seen that auto enroll is a good strategy. Is there anybody who didn't like it or didn't think it was persuasive? How about the auto escalate? We heard some interesting testimony today as well as last meeting. I don't think it's for us necessarily to set a rate. I mean, we heard some very specific research on rates. That's probably a deliberation point for my colleagues in the legislature, but you know, it's relevant.
Yeah, and the concern that we've heard, you know, at least on the private side, is if you don't have wage growth and you're taking money out of paychecks and people are living check to check, it becomes pretty big burden. So even talking 2%, if someone really is getting to the end of their paycheck and they got $5 in their pocket, that $5 goes away. Now they don't have $5. Mm-hmm. So,
but they could still opt out.
Opt out, right?
Still opt out, but it's not what you want people doing. So that's where plan designs become a lot more complex when you actually get into them. So
you asked the question of one of the presenters about. They were asking about talking about 1 or 2%, but you mentioned 0.5%. Can you help me understand that a little
bit?
So
on the matching part, if you were going down, which again it's an ERISA plan if you do any matching. What is starting to happen in the industry, instead of doing a full percent, people are starting to go, hey, I want people to contribute more money. I want them to contribute 8 to 10%, so I'll do 0.5% up to 8%. It's the same amount. I was doing 4% like your Oregon State or the Oregon teachers one, or professors one, sorry. Now instead of doing 4% for, you know, 1% for 4, you do 0.5% up to 8. And that seems to be a trend that's starting to happen.
The escalation level is 0.5%. Then.
Not escalation, it's matching. It's only on the matching part.
That's okay. I understand.
Harley, on the small business side, and I understand you're talking about the incentivization side, which is great. There's another aspect to the small business testimony we heard that was intriguing to me regarding administrative requirements. If again, there's a big underscored if here, if there was some sort of a state-sponsored, incentivized, plan, whatever one wants to look at, the question from my perspective is what happens with small employers if they are included and again, California excluded a certain number, but let's assume they are included, that do not have automatic payroll functions. The question I have is, what is actually required? Administratively, what does it look like? How does it work? Can it work? What does it cost?
Yeah.
What options are available? Dick had mentioned the Department of Revenue is working on something. I don't know whether that's accessible to companies, small businesses that don't currently have an automated payroll system. I'd like to know more about that particular aspect.
I really agree with you. What does it cost? You know, what's the incremental cost to a small business of implementing this, or to a larger business of implementing this? I think we need to know that as people are determining the sort of value proposition in this. So if that's one of the things that you're going to look at in terms of identifying, you know, how do we chart how to make this work as well as possible, or at least the considerations in terms of small businesses, so we can decide whether it's doable. I think that's important. I also think that it would be interesting to know about opt-out or some kind of tax. You know, is there some sort of tax credit or some benefit that a business owner can get if it costs them some amount of money and they're really quite small businesses, as an incentive to participate, to pick up that incremental cost?
The legislature did ask specifically under one of these line items for potential
tax incentives,
and I think that's, it was F, subsection F, I think that's what they were getting at. I'm not positive, and we could go back and see the deliberations in the legislative body, but I believe they were looking for offsets like that, was my understanding. I don't know, Jan, if you had a different perspective on that.
I don't. This group hasn't discussed any of the tax incentive questions, so maybe there can be a short discussion in August on
that would be interesting. Yeah, that would be interesting. And if we could get a deeper dive into legislative intent on subsection F, that'd be helpful.
Okay.
The only issue there would be, though, is that with the large number of tax-exempt organizations, that tax, they would not be able to take advantage of the tax credit, but would have the same burden, if you want to call it that, of enrollment and administration, which, by my way of thinking, the more we can simplify all that, we can drive that cost down to almost zero, I think.
Bert?
Due to time concerns and me being somewhat of a late appointment to bring that up, that's been one of my talking points, is what incentives can be given to new businesses, the 600, the backbone of our economy here, too, right from the inception when somebody starts a business with one or two employees, to simply give them some sort of advantage to be able to start out with a retirement plan. Ideally, the simple plan, which is now available, up to 100 employees, is really quite simple, having set up a couple of them. There's generally an employer match, which is required, which, you know, employers starting out, you know, as a survey said, you know, the average employer doesn't save as much as the employees because they're putting everything back into the business. That's their hope to sell it later, perhaps, to build up an equity. But I think that avenue hasn't been pursued enough in my limited time here on the committee. And I think the private sector providing simple plans, they've outside of the payroll deductions, there's no major ERISA guidelines to go by. It is just that simple. And again, reiterating, 20% of them, when it's available, the company will give you $10, you put in $10, you save for retirement. About 15-20% don't do it. I mean, maybe we skipped over the whole educational aspect. Again, this is a generational problem. We've gotten away from educating our kids, but making them feel it. I was interesting that Professor and I were on the same wavelength with looking brain wavelength here, and looking the motivation of people and have them grow up simple hands-on methods to people appreciate and feel. It's to feel it. All the paperwork we do, everything we write down, if it doesn't have feeling, it can be the proverbial, you know, build it, and they won't come because it's intangibles. I think we haven't perhaps pursued that enough as an alternative to us, a new full-fledged statewide plan like California or something.
Bert, is there some information you might be able to dig up over the next couple of weeks that would be of relevance that you could send us, please, prior to the meeting? Be happy to have a conversation about it.
Well, just I'll have information on simple plans, what they entail, and there's some simple brochures. And besides from that, I'm not a guru on facts, figures, how many people participating. I just know the hands-on with it, but I'll share what a simple plan is and the requirements. I'll probably have some company brochures from one of the many companies. Principal Funds has a good brochure. Make sure everybody has a copy to follow along.
Good. Thanks, Bert. All right. I have taken you 4 minutes over. I apologize for that. We started 5 minutes late, so we're out 1 minute short. We will next meet then, just to make sure I've got this, August 6th at 1 p.m., and you should expect to get some information prior to that. Poor Jan has a very, very full docket for that meeting. I want to thank everybody who presented today. They were very provocative and timely conversations. I want to thank everybody here who's participated in these meetings and has had a lot of follow-up conversations with us in the interim. We appreciate your input. Without any further ado, we're adjourned. Thanks, folks.
When should I
do? We're adjourned. Thanks, folks.
When should I?
Without any further